They played a huge role in Argentina. I mean, it was them who got the court decision that actually prevented Argentina from paying its paying the interest payments on its debt to all the creditors, the over 90% of creditors who accepted a restructuring. So I think the main role, the main negative role that the hedge funds, the vulture funds, as they're accurately called, is the main role they play is to make it more difficult to have a restructuring when there is one. And so that's a very serious problem, and it's caused enormous problems for Argentina. In Greece right now, of course, the main problem is still the European authorities. They're the ones that are, you know, they're not really fighting over the money in Greece. It's really about forcing Greece to make these changes. And also, they're worried about, I mean, about what's going to happen in the rest of Europe. Because, for instance, if Greece were to win this battle, you would be much more likely to see Podemos, a left party that didn't even exist about a year and a half ago and is now leading in the polls. They could win the election in November. So that's another thing they're looking at. They really, this really is a political project, and it's really driven more by this politics than the actual payments on the debt, which they could have settled in Greece a long time ago for a lot more, a lot less than what they're going to lose going forward.
Well, we'll leave it there on Greece and one on Puerto Rico. The piece that you did, hedge fund moguls who played a role in Puerto Rico's money woes will be greeted by protesters at swanky fundraiser for Governor Cuomo. This is an East Hampton $5,000 plate fundraiser.
Yeah, on Saturday night, yes.
And there'll be protests outside.
There's supposed to be protests outside, yes.
Well, we'll link to that piece as well. And Mark Weisbrot, thanks for joining us, economist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, author of the forthcoming book, Failed, What the Experts Got Wrong About the Global Economy. That does it for our show. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for all links and transcripts, video and audio podcasts.
All right. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8:01. Time for Positively Revolting.
What would you have instead?
No, this is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought, tell the world how you cast your vote.
Thank you.
And good morning. Good morning, Portlandia. It is 8:04 in the morning, and you are listening to KBOO, your very own community radio station. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. I'm Lynn, and my lovely host, co-host Ani, is taking the day off because she is not feeling well. She'll be back next week, and we'll all be very happy about that. And this morning, I just want to get no jiggery pokery. We're just going to get right into it this morning because it's a really important topic. We're going to talk about the Portland Renters Assembly that is going to be happening. There's two, it's the third one that's going on. There's going to be two meetings. One is Sunday, July 12th. From 12 to 2 in the North Portland Library, 512 Northeast Killingsworth. We'll talk about these. We'll get your pencils out because we'll talk about these dates more. And Wednesday, July 15th at Colonel Sumner's Park in the covered area near 17th and Taylor. And here to be discussing all this with me this morning is we have, first of all, Jamandria Harris. She is a poet, artist, and an activist with Black Lives Matter PDX. Good morning, Jamandria.
Good morning.
Speak up a little bit.
Good morning.
There you go. Eat that mic, baby. And we have, excuse me, Mara Sussman, who is one of the organizers of Portland Renters Assembly, and she also works for an early childhood program at Impact Northwest. Good morning, Mara.
Good morning.
And then, last but not least, is Tori Abernathy, artist, educator, activist, and the initiator. It's your fault, huh, of the Portland Renters Assemblies. So let's just start off with, and whoever wants to take this, why do we need such a thing as a renters assembly? Aren't people just happy as little larks here in Portland with what's going on with their living arrangements? Mara, you want to take that?
Yeah. I think there's been, huge crisis with housing right now in Portland, and everyone's feeling it, everyone's talking about it, and everyone feels pretty powerless around it. And so...
Well, so what is the crisis exactly?
There's a lack of housing. There's a lack of affordable housing. There's a lack of safe housing. People don't have any security as renters. There's really no protections for renters. Their lease can be terminated for no reason. They call it no cause termination or no cause evictions. There's no rent control. So people are seeing their rents rise. Sometimes multiple times a year, and not at all in congruence with where their wages are. People are getting pushed out of the center of the city, so that we're seeing people just being really displaced from their communities and neighborhoods and having to commute really far from work or having to lose jobs because of the instability. The assemblies, like when I first heard about the assemblies, when Tori first put them on in February, I thought, this is great. This is an opportunity for people to just come together and at least have some community or solidarity around what's going on and just talk about it. So,
Tori?
Yeah, I think that's totally accurate. And I guess I would just say that also, at least from where I'm coming from, I feel like rent itself, not just now, but always, is just a parasitic system that is based on the idea of, taking the last remaining sort of capital from those who are not the owners, right? And so, like, by its very nature, it is something that we should get rid of. And so this is, for me, maybe a way to, get people together to share their experiences so that they understand that they're not alone in that situation. Like, they're not alone in feeling trodden down by these kind of forces. And I think that in doing that, you can kind of break down the walls, right? And understand that it's not just those who are, like, in your income bracket or not just your neighbors who are experiencing, like, a similar problem, but it's people from all walks of life. And it's people in very different types of housing situations too, who are all experiencing the same thing. So
Jamandria, this has been going on in the Black community for a really long time.
Yeah, I'm gonna take a little
Cinemage, off of what Toy was saying, you know, basically anti-blackness is like inherent and constitutive of like the formation of the nation state itself. So the black community, the black body is always fungible, is always subject to violence and exclusion. Capitalism doesn't exist without black bodies and the violence against black bodies. So taking it all the way back down, gentrification is a form of colonization. When black people in places like Portland, especially places like Portland and Oregon, which were made to be white homelands, which were like systematically constructed in a really intensely violent way to be white homelands, come here right now in this time period, you face violence even if you are in the right income bracket, even if you have, you know, you're like an employed member of the creative class, you're like an artistic person, you're a teacher, whatever. Black people, people of color, but black people in particular in Portland, it's very, very difficult to find housing in the city. Around the city, the rings of suburbs around the city is where all the black communities have been pushed out to. And I feel that now that we're experiencing this like second wave of gentrification, or even like the creative class, the artistic people, who white people who pushed out the black people, are now being pushed out for like another class of people who are consumers of the culture that was put in place by the original artistic classes going on, I feel like there's a need to recenter the fact that, you know, black people who are in that class never had that space. Their place in rental spaces has always been based on like the being abject before whiteness. Speaking from personal experience and from the experience of like basically almost every black person that I know in Portland, it's just a massive struggle to even find a place that will rent to you regardless of your income. To find a, even to get a house, if you can afford to like get a mortgage, it's impossible. I know a lot of people, if you have a white partner or a white friend, you send them out. They'll be an accomplice and you'll send them out to try and get, you know, your foot in the door. And then when you show up, especially myself as like a black single mother, you show up with your child, no matter how much money you're bringing to offer on the table, all of a sudden that apartment's not available, that house is not available, etc. So there's a lot of work to be done, not just around making rent. Well, yes, rent needs to go away. The whole ownership society needs to go away. But there's a lot of work to be done with white people understanding that you have to be wedges for black people, because we are always like unable to fit into the, any of the spaces that are available, any of the rental spaces, any of the housing that's available. That struggle has to be centered as well. Because, you know, if black people have space, if we can like put that over, then of course there'll be space for like, you know, white people who are economically disadvantaged, since like we are at the bottom of that pyramid.
Yeah. So isn't one of the assemblies, which one, the Wednesday one, aren't you going to really start talking about that intersectionality? Intersectionality. No, that's not what it is. Could be, I don't know. But the how race and housing, as you were saying, Jamandra, how that is, that's huge.
Yeah, so the assembly on Sunday is going to focus on those issues, mm-hmm. with speakers from Black Lives Matter, including Jamandria, and then also Carmen Dennison. And then
hopefully, so who is Carmen Dennison for our listeners? So
she's an artist and activist and writer who is working in nonprofits. Right now she works as a college counselor for, you know, at-risk youth.
There's a lot of air quotes going on this morning, by the way.
But yeah, so she's going to be speaking a bit about, I guess, also the concept of gentrification, but in a slightly different way. I think she's trying to propose a new term for that, because I think that she feels that displacement itself, the word has a lot of like power inscribed within it, right? Like the gentry versus the savage, let's say. And so then on Wednesday, we're going to be focusing on sort of more organizing tactics and strategies for mobility. And we'll have a few speakers on that. Mara, did you want to?
Sure, yeah. We're so I think we're going to have some folks from PDX Solidarity Network who do a lot of direct action around working class people's movements. And somebody, or I think Toby Green, volunteer with the 15 Now campaign, is going to come and speak. And we're really excited about you know, in general, this round of assemblies is really trying to bring to the surface that idea of like our movements or politics have to be intersected. You know, we have to be collaborating really deeply in building these coalitions because they're not separate issues at all. And especially, you know, the fight for a higher minimum wage along with tenant rights and the housing stability. So that's really exciting. And then of course, yeah, Jamandria and the Black Lives Matter folks being there to bring some education and some perspective. But I think ultimately the assemblies are meant for people to learn and to become agitated, you know, to plug into existing networks and to maybe envision like a new way of being and where there's more safety and security. And
well, I'll just throw this out there. Do y'all see, don't things seem like they're really boiling nicely these days that I don't know how big a deal it is that the Confederate flag got taken down. I mean, about time, who cares in some ways, right? She's giving, Jamandria's giving this look like, minor stuff. And I agree.
Oh, yes, Bree.
However, Bree, oh my God. Of course, we all love, why can't I think of her last name? Bree-see. You can't either.
Yeah, I'm bad at last names.
I know. But that, yes, she's amazing. The fact that, I love that she just went up there and took that flag down. But also, I just see, I don't know, hopefully things that people have had it. Black people are now, it's a whole new generation of folks that are doing activism in different ways. Do you see that at all, Jamandria? And that I don't think things just seem boiling and bubbling more. Or do you? How do you feel about that?
I was going to say her last name is Bree Newsom.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Voila. Pardon. All praise Bree.
Yeah, Bree. Absolutely.
But also, I think that what happens is that black radicalism activism comes in and out of white consciousness. Mm-hmm. It comes in and out of the hegemonic discourse. It never goes away. There's always movement. And this current moment is like not just a youth moment. It is the culmination of just like the inherent violence of the nation state and anti-blackness reaching, I don't even want to say like a pinnacle. It's just like, you know, there's all these issues that did not get processed that at every time there has been like a step forward, it doesn't go all the way forward. And so these issues come back up again. And it's just because of the continuance of the nation state. It's because like anti-blackness is inherent. It is really hot right now. Things are pretty popping, but you know, it really, I feel that until we have just like an abolitionist discourse with everything, there's not going to be a change. It's not that people now, the difference I think now is people are more so aware, like there's a wider awareness that you're not agitating for change within the system. You're advocating for change that like destroys the system and is about decolonization, which requires the vision of a new world of mm-hmm. like a new way of engaging with everyone and everything. And with regards to the Confederate flag, I mean, the Confederate flag is just, it's like a symbol that people, I think a lot of people, I think of white people especially, kind of are focusing on the Confederate flag when like actually like Oregon has like, you know, the guy who, one of the men who inspired the massacre, the terrorist in Charleston, that boy, he's from the white homeland people up here in Oregon. Like Oregon is known to be like the most racist state outside of the South. And so when I hear, especially white people, if you're talking about like the Confederate flag, I'm like, oh, how can they still have that? I mean, I don't know. I'm from Texas originally. One of the first political acts I ever committed was I wrote for my high school paper. I was like associate editor. We did the nameless editorial, you know, because I didn't want to put my name on it, but they knew it was me. I was the only black person. But I wrote against the Confederate flag in the school paper. And I mean, all these teachers and all these students were very angry at me because they knew it was me because I was pretty. I was like, you know, as militant as you can be in a white suburb and being like one of the only black children, but I was pretty. They knew it was me. And I think the only thing that stopped, you know, teachers messing with me was my parents being very stroppy and loud and like being like, you better not. And still, you know, the Confederate flag is just a symbol. The racism in itself is still there. And it's really, it's like, you know, but it's like not worse than the racism up here. I mean, sometimes I've thought living up here.
No, I would never say that.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm just saying, like, sometimes I've thought, like, I've living up here for like 8-9 years that I'm like, I almost miss people who will just like be racist in your face and acknowledge that I am racist, and then you can work through them. I mean, it's like when I was younger, like, and I was going to school in Texas and, you know, college, I've dated people who were just like racist, you know, but they were like, but I love you. And but up here you'll date people who are like, I'm not racist, and like, I can't even like talk about how I have all these microaggressions and how I'm actually like fetishizing blackness, or how I think that like somehow like black people from the continent of Africa are more real than like black Americans, or like how I'm going to tell you more about what I know about black culture than you do because this is my aesthetic choice. You know, there's all of that going on, and that's just as violent. Mm-hmm. That's about a lot of erasure. But would I be able to have space to talk about some stuff that Black Lives Matter is doing right now, or should I wait till later?
I'm going to do a little ID first, and then and let people know that they can call in, because we're going to have a little renters assembly here. We want to hear your comments and questions for our wonderful guests. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. I am Lynn. I am here this morning with Tori Abernathy, Mara Zussman, and Jamandria Harris of Black Lives Matter. Mara and Tori are with the Renters Assembly, a bunch of artists and activists, which is, how much fun is that? And we would like to hear from everyone, 503-231-8187, or you can contact us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. We are on the Facebook at Positively Revolting, and we also do the Twitters. I see people on their phones here doing it, because I don't do it. But other people do it for us, which is really nice. Anyway, Jamandria, what is going on with Black Lives Matter?
Well, we are going to the Movement for Black Lives conference in Cleveland in the middle of the month. And there is an Indiegogo for us to raise money for our tickets. So if people are interested in supporting Black Lives Matter PDX in any way, I can give you a website address where you can go and give us support financially. If you want to support Black Lives, show your support. In some ways, this is the best thing that white accomplices can do, is use the resources that you have access to that Black people cannot access to fund Black radical activities. And this website it's an Indiegogo. And I think if you just search like Black Lives Matter Portland, and let's see, it's life.indiegogo.com/fundraiser/black-lives-matter-portland.
Do that one more time.
It is life.indiegogo.com/fundraisers/black-lives-matter-portland. And that's where you guys can go to donate.
Excellent. Yeah. And we'll put that on our website, too. So it'll make it easy for people. Well, now we have a fellow named Peter, who is a landlord, who's on the phone. He wants to, Peter, so do you want to let people know how to be a better landlord?
Well, no, that's what I would like you guys to kind of help, you know, enlighten me, because, I mean, I'm just to be clear,
are you a landlord?
Perfect.
You're a landlord.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
So, and I feel like, you know, completely torn and hypocritical and kind of a jackass, because, you know, I mean, I just raised the rent like last week on a tenant, and so, you know, they could likely be saying, well, geez, Peter's like the biggest, you know, jerk around. But like, I'm feeling somewhat vulnerable and defensive, but, you know, I mean, I'm more than happy to learn whatever I can. I mean, I've got a $35,000 roof to replace, and so, but, you know, so, and I'm looking at building a new apartment.
Peter, you have to keep it really clean if you're going to keep being on the air.
I apologize. So there's, I'm looking at building a small building, and I would like to know what would be a good design or approach for what's appropriate and what would be good. Like, I mean, 500 square feet, or, you know, please tell me. I'd like to learn.
Does anyone, what do you think?
So,
Tori?
With regards to the condition of the landlord, I mean, I think that, you know, for one, you should come to the assemblies and hear what people have to say, and maybe we can come up with some ideas together. But also, I think that, you know, no one is necessarily claiming here, at least, that the landlords aren't put in a difficult position and that they have, you know, difficulties of their own, let's say. But I guess what we're vying for is maybe a situation in where housing is conceived of more as a human right than an industry and a business. And so in that alternate reality that does not yet exist, right, there would be no need for someone such as yourself to be making a living in that way, right? Because there, and you would have maybe ways that you could find alternate sources of income, right? Or I don't know, maybe it's an entirely different world altogether, and maybe you don't have to do that, right? So I mean, like, I think that it's maybe I don't have the answers for you right now, and I don't know if anyone else has something they would want to say about that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you say that you feel vulnerable and defensive, because I think that's how renters feel all the time, you know, because they're basically their home and their whole sense of stability is kind of based on the whims of their landlords. And there are great landlords out there. I think a big crisis that we're facing right now is due to out of state, you know, big investors and development companies.
The private landlords are doing a better job than the out of state folks that are just buying up property.
Some of them, but I think some of them are also trying to take advantage of, what can we get? Like, what is the market? What can the market sustain? And Peter, I mean, I think it's great that you're calling and that you're caring about it, because you can't, you know, what Tori said, like the way the current system is operating, like, yes, it's a business. And yes, you're trying to make a profit and you're trying to, you know, continue on. But there are reasons, you know, you don't have to charge what the market will allow. You can talk to your tenants about what kind of an increase they can sustain. I mean, I think most tenants do realize that every once in a while their rent may increase due to tax raises, you know, all those kind of things. And so talk to your tenants about it and see, like, you know, if you're trying to prevent displacing them, just have a frank conversation and you know, feel good about knowing that you are providing a service in a consciousable way.
I haven't heard that word for that phrase, that they're providing a service.
Well, interesting. It's also a basic need. Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, that's the thing, is it's not just a business. It's a basic need.
Yeah, there's more to people are trying to live somewhere. Jamandria, you look like you have something to say.
I was going to say that in my experience, I mean, I feel that, like, the big corporate landlords are, like, kind of, like, systemic racism, but then the interpersonal racism that happens is coming from private landlords. So one step that, like, small, quote-unquote, landlords can do is to be actively unpacking racism. This may be dedicated to dismantling whiteness, dedicated to anti-racism and decolonization, understand the ways in which their perceptions and who they choose to rent to are influenced by racism, and to actively work towards unpacking that. And if that takes leaning towards renting to Black tenants who have so much difficulty, if a private landlord has, like, because I've encountered that a lot of private landlords have a lot of quietly racist practices in their head, and so they feel less affinity towards, like, Black people coming seeking apartments. I've actually faced, like, the most racism from private landlords, actually. And that's, like, a form of violence in Portland, where there's a lot of people who consider themselves liberal, but they don't want to rent to Black people. And they say that that's because of practical reasons or bad experiences or all these things. But it's really, they need to look at that.
Practical reasons?
Yeah, they say practical reasons. They need to look at that.
She's air quoting again.
And unpack the racism inside of that and work on that. And also, yeah, it is a service that you're providing. Instead of it being power over and thinking about, like, how you as the landlord, as the boss, as, like, somebody who maybe you're not living, like, rich and fancy free, etc. But that's not what we're saying. We're saying that you do have power, you have hegemony. Try and destabilize that, unpack that, have it be like a sharing situation as opposed to a power over situation.
Do you think, kids, it's possible? You know, I always hate to suggest legislation because I don't think that generally works, but some sort of regulation needs to happen. I know that we want to not have rent, but first, doesn't some sort of regulation need to be happening here just to stop this skyrocketing?
I mean, Portland is a wild west with regards to like.
No, I know. I know.
It's pretty wild.
I can think of a time that I got a house. This was back in the 80s in North Portland because I was white. I know that to be a fact. And so we've got, it's so complicated. There are so many issues going on. There is, this is late stage capitalism that we're going through here now. And it is, you're right, it's the Wild West. It's exploding. It's feudalism to me. I mean, I think we've even gone past capitalism. We're kind of in a feudal state now. I don't know what Marx said about that, if that was part of the road to revolution or not.
Can I say something about that? So like capitalism, primitive capitalism was something that came out of feudalism.
Yeah.
And colonization was this thing where like European economies could not sustain themselves. They couldn't sustain their population. And so colonization was necessary for capitalism to begin and for Europe to become sustainable. People were sick. People were starving. They couldn't sustain themselves. And the return to feudalism is not, it's like a return to feudalism because capitalism is collapsing. It was like this, it's like been this big wedge between like what has been coming. It was like put off, you know, by draining resources from all around the world to feed Europe and its aims. And then now it's coming to where like there's no more water. There's, you know, everything is coming to like a head because now we're going to have to go back to feudalism. Now we're just going to have to go back to like all these building block things because that's what's left. That's what's, you know, the power structure that's there underneath all of that.
Yeah. And I don't think that the planet can sustain industrial civilization anyway.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Particularly. Let's go back. I digress. Okay. Let's go back to the what I was talking about with legislation and some sort of regulation.
Yeah, I was actually thinking because you started talking about sort of the planet and this like this idea of the Anthropocene and like Nick Caleb, who's running for city council next year, just came out with an op-ed in Street Roots, and I just thought it was really awesome because he talks about like last week the Portland City Council approved an update to the climate action plan, and he spoke to how, you know, it's kind of a fallacy if the city's not going to address the housing displacement that's happening and just general sort of attack on working class people. He writes, like environmental and social justice are inseparable. A high density city with tremendous bike infrastructure and strong resource and efficiency standards is a worthy goal, but not unless existing residents can actually afford to stay and enjoy the benefits. Similarly, policy or lack thereof that displaces our most vulnerable residents is environmentally unjust, no matter what eco-friendly infrastructure appears after the fact. Chasing after green abstractions while ignoring the basic human right to housing runs afoul of climate justice. The city has charted a course toward a magnificent green city that only the wealthy will be able to afford to inhabit, and one that will see our most vulnerable communities suffer the worst effects of climate change. Mm-hmm. And I think that's in line, too, with how communities of color have faced the worst impact of environmental devastation, and yet it's really hard, I think, for people of color or for low income people to sort of enter into activism around environmental justice because they're in such survival mode because their basic needs aren't being met. So I just really appreciate that the conversation where those issues come together. And and as far as the law, like the legislative, I mean, I'll just kind of, for folks that don't know, like rent, there's a ban on rent control in the state of Oregon. So that has to be repealed before we can get rent control. And there's a lot of great organizations here and across the state that are working towards that.
What are some of those?
Like, for example,
How can people get in touch with those if they want to?
Sure. So
go to the Renters Assembly, I suppose.
Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely, and we can connect you. But for now, the Portland Socialist Alternative is working on that. The Oregon Community Alliance of Tenants is working on that in a different way, among the others that you can think of now.
Well, there's been a huge collaborative effort recently, this End Displacement Now campaign, which is in Portland, to sort of fix or, you know, stop the gentrification that's happening. And there's a lot of organizations and really great people doing work around housing injustice. And there's the PDX Renters Unite group that you talked about.
Yeah, and they're great. They have a great Facebook page, which is just full of all kinds of mm-hmm. horror stories.
Mm-hmm. And also, like, the early stages of organizing around
that too.
I was gonna say something about environmental justice among like communities, particularly in Black community. It's not that, I mean, there's a lot of there's the Sojourner's Land, there's the Black Land Project, there's a lot of urban, taking people out of urban environments into the countryside, into rural environments. I mean, a lot of Black people had land, it was taken from them systematically, and a lot of Black people, you know, are in urban areas where it's just been made illegal for them to engage with their environment. Also, environmental activism is kind of notorious for erasing the struggle of Black people. Mm-hmm. And so people are alienated, can't really participate. And there's a lot of, you know, Black organizations where people are working for environmental justice for Black people. But I think that one of the key things for that to be more successful is for like people who organize around the environment to kind of center Black lives, the fact that like white bodies are like settler bodies mm-hmm. on the land, and you going back to the land is like a result of your white hegemony and privilege, and your ability to access all this stuff is a part of your hegemony and privilege, and you need to be like always front loading that and unpacking the, you know, interpersonal constructions of like whiteness. And you don't need to like throw away the idea that like, oh, we're all one people on this land, we're all these, like, we're all indigenous to the land. And I'm like, no, you are not indigenous. Mm-hmm. You are trying to learn always humbleness mm-hmm. in approaching like mm-hmm. people of color, Black people in this regard. I just wanted to interject that.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and I think that I think that what we're talking about now, like what we're kind of talking, everyone's talking about, we're talking around it, is really crucial to the whole of the conversation. Because, you know, as Nick is pointing out, right, he's saying that if we're moving towards this green city, it might be one that only the wealthy will be able to afford. But I think that it's more than that, right? It's the people that are white, wealthy, able-bodied are going to, for example, among other things, are going to be able to afford, you know? Like, it's a space that is designed for a very certain type of population in mind by a certain population, right? Without considering the needs of like a broader community. And so this is something that comes up, like I was just at a panel a couple months ago about like sustainability in Portland, right? But it was like about
ooh, that's
race
a big
and sustainability.
Oh, okay, there.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, that's a big, that's, where would you go there?
Yeah, and I think, and like, Karen Gibson, Kat Goner, I'm really bad, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, and then also someone else from the city was there, and you know, it was just sort of, it was so horrible to hear him, like, you know, so honestly vying for, like, this idea of growth and sustainability as the only option, as the best option, after hearing, you know, like, Karen go on about the history of like this kind of, you know, displacement as a result of these kinds of practices. But yet it's really difficult to disentangle oneself if you're in that mindset from the idea that this like sustainability that you've done so much research about is the best option, right? Because you're not necessarily considering who that sustainability is for, you know?
Well, and that growth is the only option.
Right.
It's like growth, like a cancer growth, actually. Yeah, well, you know, and this is something that's been nationwide. It's come to Portland just a little bit later, You know, it started in New York a long time ago. God knows the Bay Area. I was talking to someone from Oakland who went, yeah, we've been hearing about, you know, that was his entire, he was probably in his early 30s, and that's his whole life had been about the displacement. Yeah, I really like displacement instead of gentrification, because that is, and it's that people come in, see something that they think is, and I'm using air quotes, a cool place to be, and I don't want to name any particular state where some people come from, but it's like, and so they want to change it. Detroit is now going through this big time.
I mean, Detroit is like straight up being colonized, you know?
Totally being colonized.
I know there's like white people who want to go there and be like, urban pioneers. So I'm like, that's what people said when they got off those boats.
I know.
Do you know what I'm saying? That's what people
said. They are going there. They're not just talking about going there. They're going there.
I know. Mm-hmm. It's like whatever artsy reason you have for wanting to go and revitalize Detroit. I'm just like, do you not realize there's like thousands upon thousands of black artists who are literally unable to like do these things because there is such entrenched racism that they can't revitalize, or they are revitalizing the city and they aren't getting the funds, they aren't getting the attention. Also, with regards to like Portland and the fetishization of Portland, I mean, I kind of feel like that's like really tied to white supremacy. I think a lot of people are resentful, especially when they come here based on like, you know, that television show or like whatever reason they're coming here for. They're like wanting this to be their fantasy white land. That accounts for the massive levels of like cultural appropriation and like interpersonal violence that happens in Portland. It accounts for, it's like the place where white people come to be whatever they can be and whatever they want, and that includes eating the other and becoming the other. So the actual presence of people of color and black people, witnessing them, is disturbing of that like white supremacist fantasy that they might be living out despite their, you know, idea of themselves as being liberal. Mm-hmm. And that too is like a part of the violence of why people are like, yes, let's build like giant condo towers and let's make only coders be able to live here, white coders, basically, with the little diverse population that isn't going to speak up, so we can live out our fantasy
with bike routes.
Mm-hmm. It's like, but we're against progress if we talk about this, right? Portland's growing up. And growing up means becoming white.
Like that was possible.
Yeah, it's just becoming whiter and richer. That's what growing up means. Adulthood is like this acquiring of white hegemony. So interesting.
All right, I'm going to give us a little idea again. We are here this morning. We're talking about the Portland Renters Assembly, the third one, and all that goes with it. My headphones are gone. I am here with Tori Abernathy, Mara Sussman, and Jamondrea Harris. We are also talking about the intersectionality of just how racism is at the very bottom of the whole thing about displacement. We're not calling it gentrification anymore. If you want to get in on the conversation, you're going to have to hurry up because we're running out of show. Number is 503-231-8187. We'd love to hear your questions or your comments. You can contact us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com if you don't feel like talking into the phone. And we are also always at Positively Revolting on the Facebook and Positive Revolt in the Twitter sphere. One more thing I just want to do is let you know what's coming up this morning on KBOO. At 9 on Democracy in Motion, Lisa Loving asked why 95% of prosecutors are white. She speaks with, I'll bet Jamondrea. You want to stay over for that show, Jamondrea? Just kidding. She speaks with Benton County Prosecutor John Haroldson, Oregon's first Mexican-American district attorney. She also speaks with Andrea Steele, founder of Emerge America. At 10 o'clock, it's Chris Andre, who hosts Air Cascadia Headlines, Interviews, and Commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, host Dennis Bernstein interviews best-selling author and reporter Greg Palast about the Greek vote against austerity. He also speaks with Grit TV host Laura Flanders about her new piece, I Am Not Dylann Roof's Woman. And at 11 on Digital Divide, in the early 60s, Marshall McLuhan wrote, the media is the message, and coined the phrase global village. He described a future where the individuals would all be connected through electronic communications, and host Rabia Yemen devotes the hour to the life and works of Marshall McLuhan. And we want to thank KBOO members for supporting your community radio station. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. It's real easy to fix not being a member of KBOO. So back to our conversation. So no matter what we do, it all boils down to race, doesn't it? What we talk about with What? I mean, that is that, it's like, I mean, of course, this country was built on racism, built on the backs of people that were brought over against their will. Even, you know, indentured folks, white folks that were brought over against their will. Everybody, to me, that seems like what, and that and genocide with Native people who were, interestingly enough, already here doing just fine.
Yeah, I have like two things I was going to say is that, like, so even like the construction of class itself is based upon like the objection of black bodies. I'm talking from the Afro-pessimist perspective. That's basically saying that the fungibility of black bodies is like the root of capitalism. There wouldn't be, like, white people would not be able to divide themselves into classes without the objection of black bodies. Black bodies stand outside the construction of the human. They had to be turned into capital. And we still stand outside the construction of the human, despite having figureheads, the fact that, like, all of, we're allowed to occupy culture, that our culture is not deemed worthy, but people imitate it. But if we talk about this, people are upset. The fact that, like, our president is only acceptable if we say nothing, if we don't bring attention to our objection to the violence against us, if we don't please and uphold whiteness. All of these games that we have to play just to be in place in society and still not having any room at all. That is like complete violence. It's inherent to the violence of capitalism. I kind of feel that for there to be any like forward movement with regards to gentrification, which is actually colonization, which is a continuation of the colonial project, it would have to be admitted by most people that this isn't about class, it is about race, and that like race is at the root of class. And this is like a thing that even radical people, radical leftists have like a problem engaging with, because people like to think that becoming radicalized is something where you get to a point and you're like, I'm not racist, I'm not misogynist, and I'm not any of these things, I am pure. And it's not about purity, it's about journey towards an unknown world where, yeah, then these categories will fall away because something new is constructed. But yeah, you cannot get away from race. You cannot do like activist work around housing or anything, any radical abolitionist work at all without centering like black people and black bodies and the needs of black communities.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Very nicely put. And but we're gonna go, we got a couple callers. If everybody's ready, let's George.
Good morning. I'm hearing that racism is at the root of it. And yet, I think if one looks all over the world, say in Latin America and other places, you will find, of course, racial groups. But these are really parts of humanity. There is racism, according to Dorothy Roberts, an African-American professor, is a political term. It won't hold up under scientific scrutiny. And what I would like to suggest is that capitalism combines with every ruthless, cruel, heartless practice, and with racism, particularly in this country and in many other countries, it fuses with it in ways that one second it looks like racism is the only factor to one person, and maybe another person says, well, it's the economy. But I think these things blend in, and there are more factors too, but these are two of the main ones. And if you ignore the economy, which you, I don't think you say you're doing, but if you ignore capitalism, I think we're going to be stuck for a long time. Well, even when you don't ignore it, we're going to be stuck for a long time, but we're going to have to fight to get rid of capitalism, and we're going to have to fight to get rid of racism. But how that can be done, I don't know. But if we don't try, we're not going to get anywhere.
Okay. Yes. Thank you, George. I don't think we were. It didn't sound to me as though we were saying one. I guess we were saying racism is at the bottom of it, but that doesn't say that we think we should keep. I don't think we've said anything about keeping capitalism around.
Being anti, I don't know. Talking about like anti-blackness is at the root of the construction of capitalism. Colonization is at the root of the construction of capitalism. I think I said that like multiple times. Black bodies turned into chattel and colonization are the only ways in which capitalism was able to exist. The constructions of classes, as we currently know them under capitalism, is rooted in blackness being outside of the construction of the human. In fact, when it was in Enlightenment philosophy, the construction of man, it wasn't just, you know, the women were not included, but also black bodies were not included. The construction of humanity, as you say, does not include black bodies. There's a book called Habeas Fiscus that's talking about the objection of black bodies, goes more into detail with that. It's written by Alexander Wahili, if you want to go look that up. And it talks about the objection of black bodies and capitalism. And there's also Caliban and the Witch, which is about primitive accumulation and the construction of capitalism. I think it's important for everyone to get a grip on how capitalism came to be so you can be effectively anti-capitalist. I think it's hard for people to understand that it goes deeper than the current economic crisis or even what is constructed in the traditional textbooks and philosophy tracks that you get. Especially, I would like to say, for maybe like people who are not as current on like a lot of the theory that comes out. I don't necessarily think that you have to be theoretically adept. I know there's things you can look at that aren't super complex, but it's also you have to understand that the way capitalism came to be, yes, is complex, but is rooted in these things. And even the ways you think of the category of race, like when you bring up it doesn't stand up to science. No, it doesn't, but science doesn't stand up to science. So, you know, quotation points.
Often.
Yeah, often. So,
Dr. can you talk about like what would you say to like white radical activists who, you know, would want to assert class over race as being somehow like the crux of the hegemony?
I mean, I know I've said this a lot of times, and I think people when they assert that, what they're asserting is their white fragility. You know, people have a certain sense of themselves embedded in themselves as an activist who's a radical, and now I've gotten past this racism thing, and we're talking about class. So I know when I'm interacting with them and they start asserting stuff like that, they're actually acting out like white supremacy. They're acting out their white hegemony. They're saying, I'm going to determine discourse. I'm going to center whiteness, and I'm going to, like, respond to the, you know, existential ontological threat that I experience when I'm forced to center a viewpoint other than my own and recenter my framework. And so I engage with them and I go like, okay, let's talk about the origins of capitalism. Let's talk about colonization. Let's talk about the history behind that. Let's talk about like Europe. If people want to bring in like the African diaspora, which would be if you're bringing in Latin America and Brazil, and people start trying to talk about like, well, they think about race differently there. And I'm like, actually, no, the United States. Okay, so the United States is so founded on anti-blackness that they didn't allow creolization. They didn't allow like the hierarchy of interracial and mixed people like they have in Latin America. But anti-blackness is still at the root of like most Latin American countries. I mean, it's pretty virulent. You can just Google that and look that up. I try and bring that out. I bring out facts about that, about anti-blackness. I point out anti-blackness in like how if you're organizing only with white people and not talking about race, then you are committing like violence. You know, I talk about stuff like that. And usually, unless people are already white accomplices, if they're not already white abolitionists, they get very defensive. And so that's, you know, how I look at that and how I engage it.
Mm-hmm. Can I respond? Okay, yeah, I think that it's really refreshing, too, to start to maybe consider what might happen if we were able to, like, accept our own, let's say, racism and sexism and, well, classism maybe, too, but just, like, really understand that and, like, take hold of it in all of our interactions and encounters and start to understand like the ways in which all of these power structures, namely capitalism, let's say, that we're attempting to like dismount are embedded in all of the different ways that we interact with each other. I mean, I think a lot about this pamphlet that I'm really obsessed with that I read all the time, that's like from Detroit. It's a black socialist feminist pamphlet from like the early 70s that is, you know, writing against wages for housework, right? In that, you know, it was kind of like missing the point, right? That let's say, you know, like black female bodies have been getting wages for your housework like the whole time or something like this. I don't know if people are familiar with the Wages for Housework campaign.
Sylvia Federici. Federici stuff.
Right, right. So
who,
like,
now don't whisper. Who?
Silvia Federici.
Like, okay. Just this idea.
Oh, yeah. And
well,
it's older than. Yeah.
Yeah, but just broader, yeah. Right. Just this idea that, like, it was from like the white feminist movement. This idea that, like, you know, quickly, like that women, people doing effective labor should be getting paid for it. Let's say.
Right.
But anyway, it's just sort of like this way in which, like, trying to understand like the historical position of all of these different. Kind of like issues allows them to exist in concert with one another and allows not only the issues to exist in concert with one another, but like the different positions to exist in concert with another one another. But that requires that you sort of understand and accept your own part in that, right?
Yeah. Everything demands that you accept your own part in it if you want to move anywhere, I think, do any kind of movement.
Yeah, I mean, like, black women doing, I mean, it's just, like, white feminism was made possible, like, in the 70s. A lot of, all the waves of, like, white feminism made possible by, like, black women not being included. In fact, early feminists fought against black women being included, and also black women had to basically be doing all of the work. Black women working for a living is not radical or revolutionary because we are forced to be beasts of burden, basically, in this culture, and then also exemplary, and also never angry, and also or angry in the way that, like, makes people, like, feel good, and they want to be behind us, not angry in the way that, like, calls you out, you know, and holds you accountable. So, yeah, people have to, like, pay attention to, like, what how your perceptions of radicalism are influenced by your whiteness.
Can we remind people about the assemblies?
Let's do that. I was going to take another caller really fast, and then we only have 3 minutes left. So first, let's talk about the assemblies.
Okay.
So we can make sure and get that. If we have a little time afterwards, we will take another caller. So go forth, Mar.
All right. So this Sunday, July 12th, from 12 noon to 2 p.m. at the North Portland Library, which is at 512 North Killingsworth Street. And Jamondre Harris is going to be there and some other folks. And you'll get a chance to talk about what it's like being a renter. And then the second one is on July 15th. This following Wednesday from 6 to 8 p.m. at Colonel Sumner's Park by the covered area, Southeast 17th and Taylor. So, yeah, I hope you guys can all come out.
It's really important to start organizing around this at this particular point. It's probably should have been done about 200 years ago, but but we start when we start. You can't change the past, but hopefully something about the future can be. People, housing is a human right. Rent is a burden. I'm interested in final comments from all of you, whoever wants to start. No? Jamondre.
My final comment is that, yeah, housing is a basic human right, but we have to expand the category of human actively and understand the center of the fact that that category hasn't always been including all human animal bodies. We are all just animals, terribly maladapted animals, not sharing our space or our planet well, and we have to relearn these skills. Actively.
True that.
So I want to thank you all for being here this morning. Tori Abernathy, artist, educator, activist, and you're the initiator of this Portland Renters Assembly thing. And Mara Zussman, another organizer who works with the childhood program at Impact Northwest. Thank you very much. And Jamondre Harris, poet, artist, and representing Black Lives Matter and herself. Very well, this morning I want to thank you all. And once again, folks, go to the renters' assemblies that are happening this Sunday at, I'm going to say this again, this Sunday at in the North Portland Library, 512 Northeast Killingsworth, and Wednesday at Colonel Sumner's Park in the covered area near 17th and Taylor. The Sunday one will be 12 to 2. The Wednesday one is, I didn't put the time down. When's the Wednesday one?
It's from 6 to 8 p.m.
6 to 8 p.m. It's all on the website at KABU. I'll put it on our Facebook page. And I'd like to thank you women once again for getting out early this morning. And it was great talking with you all. And tune in next week because we'll be positively revolting as ever, folks. Bye-bye.
Good morning, everyone. It is just a few seconds before 9 a.m., and you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Democracy in Motion with host Lisa Loving, and it will be followed at 10, as almost always, with Chris Andre, who hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, and at 11, it's the Digital Divide with host Rabia Yemin. She devotes the hour to the life and the works of Marshall McLuhan. Thanks, KBOO members, for your supporting your community radio station. If you're not a current member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate today.
Tune in to the podcast Probable Cause This on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/probablecause. On this podcast, I look at the top stories on the lack of a